In this second hour of the program, we'll be talking about Haiti, about politics and human rights issues there. And our guest for the program is Thomas Griffin. He is an attorney. He is a founding partner of the law firm of Morley, Surin & Griffin in Philadelphia. He has been active in a number of areas of law, particularly in immigration law. And for quite a while now, he has been working to try to get more information to Americans about Haiti, the great poverty there, and the issue of human rights there. He leads groups on education and service missions to Haiti and actively supports human rights and justice work there in Haiti. He has a particular interest in human rights and also was part of a delegation that went to Mexico not too long ago trying to devote some attention to an unsolved murder of a human rights attorney there in October of 2001. He was in Haiti last year and in fact produced a report looking at violations of human rights in Haiti last fall. This is a story, a report that was published and put out by the Center for the Study of Human Rights at the University of Miami Law School and is available through them if you would like to take a look at it. As we talk in this part of Focus 580 with Thomas Griffin, questions certainly are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who are listening is that they try to be brief in their comments just so that we can keep things moving. But, of course, anybody is welcome to call and join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the local number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, if you're listening around Illinois or Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel, or for that matter, over the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Griffin, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
No problem. Glad to be here.
You've been interested in Haiti for some time now. How did that interest get started?
I had a historical interest through the 90s when a good friend of mine left his corporate law practice to go and help the government to prosecute the human rights abuses that happened during the first coup against Aristide from 1991 to 1994. So while he was in Haiti for about 6 or 7 years during the mid 90s into the early early 2000, I guess 3-4, would just follow all his work. And then I made my first trip in 2000. It was sort of unrelated. It was sort of a spiritual retreat where I went to with a group to sort of just get a sense of what it was to live among the poor. And then later in 2000, I actually went to see the culmination of my friend's work, which was the Robitaux massacre trial in October and November of 2000, which was hailed as the greatest trial in the history of Haiti, and by international observers as one of the best trials in the world that year in terms of fairness and the rule of law, et cetera.
Well, and tell me about specifically about the trip that you made last fall.
Okay. Gradually, I guess since 2000 when I made my first trip, I've just become more and more interested in finding out why people starve on a regular basis in Haiti. And then I decided to see what I could do to try to get the word out and maybe even stop it. With the latest coup against Aristide that took place in the night of February 28th, 2004, things started to get really crazy in Haiti and on the street. And I made a first investigation about a month later because I had been hearing from my colleagues and different connections I had made over the years, that bodies were turning up in the street everywhere, that young boys were turning up in the morgue by the dozens with their hands tied behind their back and black plastic bags over their heads. But it wasn't making the newspaper, so I decided to go. And as a leader of a National Lawyers Guild delegation, I was able to document a lot of what I've heard, and it was retaliation, against Aristide, or Aristide supporters, and that's who was turning up in the morgue. Were people that were seen as Aristide supporters, the supporters of the ousted government. And then when I went back, as the summer went on, I heard about more and more things going on, and then things really heated up in about August of 2004, when people crying out for democracy started to organize and have peaceful demonstrations, and the Haitian National Police were actually shooting at them, and bodies were turning up on the street again in high numbers, and no one was reporting it. Then I heard there was a massacre of 12 boys that were tied together by the Haitian National Police and shot right in the middle of their neighborhood at midday, and yet it wasn't making the paper. So I finally said in November, I've got to go. No one else is doing it. And so I was sort of compelled to go down and report it. And I took a camera with me, and that's what formed the basis of the report that you're talking about that I did for the Center for the Study of Human Rights at Miami Law School.
Yeah. I came across a quote that really strikes me as having a lot to say. This was as a quote from Robert Pastor, who was director of Latin American Affairs for Jimmy Carter. He said, U.S. attention to the region, talking about the Caribbean, U.S. attention to the region has fluctuated between obsession and disinterest. I have referred to this pattern as a whirlpool, a whirling eddy which occasionally sucks the United States into a vortex of crisis where it becomes preoccupied by small neighbors or their leaders. U.S. presidents react to these crises with security, political, and economic programs that have their historical antecedents, even if the policymakers of the time are not aware of them. Then, almost as suddenly, U.S. interest and resources shift away from the region, and many Americans can hardly recall either their nemesis or the reason for their intervention. I think it's very telling. It seems to me to be quite accurate and to say something both about the way the government approaches the Caribbean and also the way that American news media approach the Caribbean, because indeed it's something that periodically, just to take Haiti for an example, violence flares up and you may see some coverage, but then that goes on to something else. And there's never really much in the way of context to try to help people here in this country understand what is going on there and what, if anything, the United States has had to do
right.
with that conflict.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty accurate summation. I think there's an incredible amount of disinterest that people are just a couple hundred miles from Disney World are starving to death, literally starving to death, just dropping dead in the street. And I think why I've been hooked on Haiti was since my first trip. I was working at a hospital in a rural region, and a 10-year-old boy had come to the hospital on the back of a donkey with his grandmother. And he was 10 years old, and he weighed 20 pounds. And for 3 days, I sat with him on his hospital bed and just watched him die. I just couldn't believe it. You know, heard about those kind of things, but couldn't believe it. And like I said, so close to us. So I think there's incredible disinterest in that, because we could stop the hunger there in no time if we were interested. And at the same time, a huge, I think, fear that when a popular government is elected by the poor, who are about 98% of the population in Haiti, incredible interest is generated by the fear of what that means for everyone. And I think it's even compounded more in Haiti than even in a place like Venezuela, because the people are black and there's huge racist issues that have been going on historically in Haiti, between Haiti and the United States, for a couple of centuries. And then what you had coming up in January 1st, 2004, was the 200th anniversary of the first black nation on earth to declare itself a republic and independent. And this was a nation of slaves. It's also the first successful slave revolution in the world, or the only successful slave revolution in the world that became its own independent state. And Aristide was about to have a huge celebration of that, and it meant a lot to people in Africa. It meant a lot to former colonies and enslaved nations. And there was a meeting in Ottawa in 2003 among some policy wonks and international affairs people from our government, Canadian government, and France that said, we can't let this celebration go on. And there was a plan to take out Aristide before he could celebrate. They were about a month late. It took them until February 2004 to get him out, but there was no celebration. No one from the United States, Canada, or France even went to it. And there's interest and there's disinterest, and we're also interested in business, being able to use Haiti for sweatshops. So there's a huge interest in that part of the United States government that encourages that kind of trade policies. Mm.
Well, here we have two administrations. Both have been active in Haiti in two very different ways. The Clinton administration actually used military force to return President Aristide in 1994. And then on the other side of this coin, there are a lot of people who believe that when the second Bush administration came into office, they wanted to get rid of Aristide because there also were conservatives in Congress who agreed, who saw him as a kind of another Castro, and they backed his opponents in the country. And he himself, Mr. Aristide, says that he did not leave the country willingly in 2004, that he was forced out by the United States.
Right.
So here we have two different administrations, both being active, but in completely opposite ways.
Sort of. You do have George Bush, the second one, finishing his dad's work. Clinton was putting Aristide back in 94 after Aristide being in exile for 3 years. First he was forced out, obviously, by a U.S.-backed coup and a group called FRAP, and the military dictatorship ruled for those 3 years. But there was a combination of factors. There's a really great movement by advocates for Haiti in the United States that was demanding Aristide's return because he was popularly elected, and there was so much suffering going on down there. There were a lot of refugees landing on Florida's shores, and I think that was upsetting the people in Florida for maybe not so nice reasons. Having all these poor black people landing in Florida wasn't really what they wanted. Because they were escaping the atrocities being committed against the poor. But when Clinton put him back, it was under conditions. And Aristide had resisted those conditions for probably about a year before he got put back. I think if he agreed faster to what Clinton wanted, he would have got back in office in 93. So a lot of those concessions he had to make were things that hurt his people and things were against his platform, such as lowering minimum wages, having sort of tax-free zones where U.S. businesses could invest and basically own sweatshops. And he was very resistant to that, but ultimately had to suck it up if he wanted to get back to his people. And that created problems itself in terms of how the people who voted for him looked at him, because they saw him as someone somewhat of a turncoat or someone who had betrayed them. And then when Bush got back, the second Bush came in 2000, things really started to crank up against him. And the over $500 million in loans from the Inter-American Development Bank were held up by George Bush. And that's when the United States began to physically choke the people of Haiti. And Aristide couldn't get anything done.
One of the things that I see referenced in so many of the stories that I read makes this very point about the fact that significant amounts, more than $1 billion in international aid, was promised by the international community, and that almost none of it has actually been received in Haiti. How much difference would that have made somewhere along the line, do you think, if these kinds of promises actually had been fulfilled?
Oh, I think it was a part of a multifaceted strategy by the Bush administration and a lot of people in the right wing Republicans to snuff out Aristide. And he had come to office, and was reelected in 2000 based on on popular programs such as building more schools, building more hospitals, fixing the roads, and fixing the water systems in Haiti. And all that money from the Inter-American Development Bank, as well as from other sources, was going to be for that reason. When George Bush stepped in, and for political reasons says, I'm not going to give that aid, like I said, the country was choked. Aristide couldn't make good on any of his promises, but at the same time, the misery the level of starvation, the level of curable communicable diseases just skyrocketed, and frustration set in, and it became a more tempting and easier turned group of people some United States programs went in there to try to turn people against Aristide. It was easier to turn them, and create an opposition where there wasn't any and where there shouldn't have been any.
Mm. So you think that the United States here was instrumental in helping to organize, to fund opposition to our state, and that that things might not be where they are today if that had not happened?
Absolutely. My report, and maybe your listeners could look at it if they're in front of a computer, they could go to www.law.miami.edu/CSHR, and you will see 60 pages of photographs and investigation of atrocities, but you'll also see some very in-depth work as to how the United States was able to use sort of covert methods of creating an opposition where there was none and toppling Aristide. But one of the great finds I made was that this group called IFIS, the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, a well-known, what they call themselves, a democratization group, that's a contractee of USAID, had a huge role in Haiti, probably over the last 10 years. But over the last 5 years, it was to destroy the Aristide government. And they did it by infiltrating different existing organizations, creating organizations that didn't exist before, wining and dining people, taking them on trips, taking them on seminars, and basically showing them through these seminars why all the bad things about Aristide and why Aristide shouldn't be in the government anymore. And eventually these oppositions were created, and they hooked up very closely with this a very rich, white, U.S. citizen sweatshop owner that lives in Haiti named Andy Appade, and helped him to create a group called the Group of 184. And that became the largest opposition to Aristide in Haiti. But as you read the report, you'll see that IFIS actually bought off journalists and turned journalists and the major papers against Aristide. They even co-opted a group called CARLI, C-A-R-L-I. It's a French acronym for a human rights group that was pretty well known down there. And they gave them a lot of money to report abuses committed by Aristide or Aristide's government or the police, but not to report any kind of abuses committed against people that supported Aristide. So you've got that. Then they turned student groups against Aristide, and things just started to boil over down there, and there became violent demonstrations started in the street.
There has been quite a bit of violence here, particularly over the last couple of years. And when you look at the stories that we see mostly, it seems to be reduced to a story of pro-Aristide versus anti-Aristide.
Mm-hmm.
And that both sides have used violence to try to control some areas of the country. The anti-Aristide, basically, these are people in the middle class and the ruling elites of the country, backed by the former military, which Mr. Aristide disbanded when he returned to the presidency in 1995, against those people who support him, and he draws a great deal of his support from the poorest people in the country. And then sort of in the middle, we have police and UN peacekeepers who don't really seem to be able to do much of anything about it. If we say that that's what the situation is that an oversimplification or somehow a glossing over of what actually is taking place?
It's somewhat accurate. There's some inaccuracies there. I mean, everyone in Haiti has an opinion whether they're for or against Aristide. It's just the different levels of it, whether it's violent or political or whatever. But there's plenty of people there's a good amount of people that want Aristide back, and I think if there were elections today, Aristide would be elected. But I think the overwhelming majority of people say, I don't care who my president is, I just want to eat today, and I want to send my kids to school, and I want to drink clean water, and I want to be able to go to hospital if I get sick. And that opens the door to saying that whoever created these conditions is to blame, and whoever's going to be new is going to be better. But that's how it's always has been in Haiti. Aristide, when he disbanded the army, disbanded what basically was effectively the private security force for the elites. And they're frustrated, and for 10 years they had no, they were wishing to finding a way to come back. Well, they found a way to come back with this U.S.-sponsored coup in February 2004, and then they physically basically put their uniforms back on, found trucks, had arms, and actually started patrolling the streets as a de facto army. And the streets they patrolled and the people they killed were all in the poor neighborhoods, and this started in just right after February 2004. What you also have is in the police force is most of the high command, and it's a couple hundred officers, were dismissed as soon as the coup happened against Aristide. And they were replaced by former militaries. So you have this incredibly angry, frustrated, and poor group of commanders in the police force throughout Haiti, and it's a national police force called the Haitian National Police, that are Aristide haters and former militaries, and they're out on a mission, and they conduct missions to kill, basically killing the poor in the poor neighborhoods. And I documented it, and I photographed it, and I watched it happen just in a matter of 1 week in Haiti in November. And it's getting worse. The latest thing is from my contacts and even some film that I've been able to see, the Haitian National Police are handing out machetes in the poor neighborhoods, so they sort of have attachés and a secret death squads working with them to kill people in the poor neighborhoods.
We are at our midpoint already. I have a caller we'll get right to, and I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Thomas Griffin. He is an attorney. He's a founding partner in the firm of Morley, Surin, and Griffin in Philadelphia. He's worked in a number of areas of law, particularly in immigration law. When he was at a law firm in Boston, he coordinated that firm's pro bono political asylum program, serving political refugees from around the globe. He spent 2 years as a federal probation and parole officer working in the Eastern District of New York, that's Brooklyn, and also in Boston for the District of Massachusetts. He has a special interest in human rights, recently was part of a delegation to Mexico looking at the unsolved murder in 2000 of a human rights attorney there. He is also interested in getting out information about Haiti and has led groups on education and service missions there. He actively supports human rights and justice work in Haiti. And if you're interested in looking at some of his recent work, you can take a look at a report that he authored looking at human rights in Haiti, November 2004. This was put out by the Center for the Study of Human Rights at the University of Miami Law School. And indeed, if you go to the University of Miami website and then go to the law school section on there, you can download the report and read it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, Champaign County, to start us off, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Hi, it's very refreshing, though, very disconcerting to hear this all laid out like this. This is absolutely brilliant. But you mentioned this meeting. What was this, a high-level meeting between France, U.S., and Canada that you were alluding to that said, well, we can't have the celebration go ahead?
Uh-huh.
Or was that done under this supposedly democratizing consortium?
It was a combination of sort of USAID, the group that's the equivalent of USAID in Canada called CIDA, the CIDA. But I think the foreign minister, Pettigrew, might have been there, and I just don't have all the attendees off the top of my head, and some people from France were there. And it was, but I think it was just one. That's one of the meetings that got out and got public, but I think it's probably just one of many meetings about snuffing out any kind of celebration in Haiti about, you know, it would have been a massive celebration of poor black people celebrating their freedom and their power to set themselves free and break the chains and take control of their own destiny, which they haven't really been able to do. They did it in 1990 when they elected Aristide, and 7 months later, and only 7 months it took for the U.S. to help get rid of Aristide, and then they brought him back, and as you know, this time it took a little bit longer, and they did it in a little bit more sophisticated way with less guns. So they haven't had time to celebrate in 200 years, and that's a major issue, the racism and the fear that the United States has.
Do you reference this in your work or somewhere on your website? Or?
It should be in the, a lot of that's in the report.
Okay.
Yep.
You mentioned this attorney friend. You didn't mention his name, but would this be this guy Quigley that doesn't
work? I know Bill Quigley. This is Brian Concannon, who was the director of the Bureau of Avocat Internationaux, which was which worked with a bunch of. He was the director, but there were a bunch of lawyers, Haitian and international, that worked very hard to put together these prosecutions of FRAP, members of FRAP.
For our Canadian friends, it seemed to me that there was a change after Chrétien passed it off to Martin, even though they were there in the same party. It seemed that that cleared the way for this, what I, the coup in Haiti. Are you, well, I don't think a lot of people know about this investigation of this UN slaughter in the Soleil district. Mm-hmm. Do you know if that's being investigated authentically by the UN in any way?
The UN, that that's the July 6th massacre?
I think so, yeah.
They went in after a Lava Loss associated gang leader named Dred Wilmay, who I actually met on my report and got to walk around City Soleil with him. But they went in after him in the most, you know, I was a federal law enforcement officer for 10 years. And in the most unprofessional way you could ever think. I mean, there's a way to take a notorious criminal down without shooting a bullet. They went in and killed him and six of his associates on July 6th, but killed and injured countless numbers of civilians, women and children. And a labor in the United States happened to be down there at the time, and they rushed over there and extended their trip and began to take photographs of some of these women and children and innocent people that had been slaughtered. And then they put out a report. It wasn't the most professional investigative report, but they put the word out. And then Doctors Without Borders, who has a wonderful clinic set up in City Soleil just to deal with wounded victims, let out the information about the numbers of women and children that were coming in with bullet wounds later that day. So under some international pressure, the UN finally started to say, we're going to investigate ourselves. One of the things they admitted to already was that they shot over 22,000 rounds of ammunition on that morning raid. And we're talking about shooting 22,000 rounds of ammunition into literally shacks made out of paper and cardboard. So, I mean, they don't just go through one house. They go through neighborhoods when the bullets start to fly. It's unbelievable to even think that the UN behaved that way. But they're not claiming, they're claiming they did some collateral damage, but they haven't said how many people they killed that day.
One other thing, and then I'll ring off, is I understand Lava Lance is going to run this father whose name I forget, and you probably know who he is. He's in jail without charge.
Yep. This is
if
second.
You could tell that story, I'd appreciate it. Thank
sure.
you very much for your work.
Okay, you're welcome. The caller's talking about Father Gerard Jean Just, who is a very prominent Catholic priest in Haiti, who was living in the United States towards the end of the Duvalier regime and set up the Haitian Refugee Center and did wonderful work for Haitian refugees in Florida. And then when Aristide was elected and took office in 91, he went back and started to and opened up his parish again and started work. He with Aristide gone and Aristide's prime minister in jail for over a year without charge, his interior minister in jail for over a year without charge, he has become the leader of the Lava Loss spokespeople. When I was on my investigation in November, he was in prison without charge and without seeing a judge for over 6 weeks. And I got into the prison, and there's a photograph in my report of him sitting in the prison. And just about, I can't really say, probably 3 weeks ago, he was arrested in a church attending a funeral of a journalist that had been killed, and the mob attacked him, an anti-Aristide mob attacked him. The police came in to protect him and then threw him in a jail cell, and he's been in ever since without charge and without seeing a judge again.
Hmm.
So I think the caller talked about Lava Loss running him for president. I think they do want him to have a role and to be a candidate, but he's in jail, so I don't know if that's even possible.
We have talked about the fact that there is a great deal of violence in Haiti today, and there are an awful lot of guns and people willing to use them, some of them with political agendas, some of them I imagine are probably just criminals. Before anything could happen, you would have to achieve some kind of stability in society and to at least get the violence to stop or down to some kind of manageable level. There are UN peacekeepers there, something over 7,000. There is a police force, but it doesn't seem that they're either willing or capable or some combination of those two to deal with this violence. What would it take if for example you said all we want to do is stop the killing? What would that take?
You'd need, and I talk about this in my report, and I talked about it with all the government officials and UN officials and State Department officials when I was down there doing my investigation. What you need is some dialogue. You need someone to set up a tent with tables and with pitchers of water and bringing in everybody to discuss what's going on and what people need. They don't want it's, that's a cheaper and safer way to do this, but what they do is they just send arms. The United States has just sent, I think, a couple million dollars worth of arms to the police in Haiti. They just don't want to talk, and that's the big problem. I think what's going to happen is if you invite someone to represent the poor masses to the table, they're going to have the power, and what they want is going to really mean something. So until the Lavalas, or sort of the movement, the mass movement of the poor, is snuffed out, they don't want to set up that table. They want to chasten people and make people afraid to even think about talking about determining their own destiny and giving some sovereignty to these people. That's why all their leaders are in jail without charge, without seeing a judge. That's why they shoot into peaceful demonstrations, because who's ever going to speak out? Because if you speak out, you'll be arrested. And if you march, you're going to be shot at. So they're doing a great job of really chastening this group, and then maybe they'll have some dialogue. But I don't think their job is finished yet, and there's got to be some more violence before they start to talk about talking to each other. The other thing they're doing is they're rushing to these elections. About 10% of the electorate has actually registered, and elections for president and parliament are supposed to take place in October and November. There's not even a candidate who has been mentioned yet, but they're pushing and pushing for these elections as if that will bring peace. Lavalas people don't want the elections because their candidates are in jail, and no registration offices have been set up in the poor neighborhoods. So they know that they would be pretty much knocked out of any elections. And I think to a large extent, the elites don't want free and fair elections, because whenever there's been free and fair elections in Haiti, their candidate doesn't win. So this violence is profiting the status quo down there. And the people who eat and the people whose factories have electricity and stuff like that are the ones who are rich and who control the police and the army.
Yeah, and that points to, just to underscore that, it points to a major, major problem about Haiti, and that is the enormous gulf between the rich and the poor, most of the people of the country being poor, and about the top, the top 1% of the population controls almost half of the wealth in the country, and almost everybody else is poor, most Haitians crushingly poor.
Oh yeah, I'd say the majority of Haitians the statistics show they live on less than a dollar a day, but they don't have running water in their houses. Even a middle class family, they might have a sink, but no water runs out of it. Their electricity is non-existent in the poor neighborhoods and is only sparse in the more middle type neighborhoods. So we're talking about a grinding, abject kind of poverty that where everyone's tiptoeing along a tightrope every day, and if one little calculation goes wrong, someone in your family dies from disease or starvation.
Well, you talked about what would have to happen to stop the violence would have to be a true sort of a sitting down with people who would be representing the interests of all of the various people, and that the interests of the poorest people and most disadvantaged people would have to be represented and would have to be addressed, something that you say the elites don't seem to want to do and have never really wanted to do. There has been, I think, some criticism made of people on all sides, though, that says something like, even if such a meeting could take place, there doesn't seem to be anyone who has a real plan, who actually seems to know what to do, has really some ideas about how to change, restructure Haiti, try to develop its economy, try to deal with the basic needs of people. Do you think that that is true, or is there someone who actually does have a plan?
I probably have to agree with that to a large extent. I don't know if anyone's been ever given the opportunity or the time to make that kind of plan. And the people that can do it are currently locked up, and the other one that could do it and was doing a pretty good job of it has been forced out of office and now is in exile in South Africa. So, and that was their elected president. I mean, they had a pretty good government in place that was bringing peace to the country, but it just wasn't ever able to start its programs running because it was constantly under attack from the United States, from violent means coercive means. So it basically had its legs cut out from under it, but those kind of people do exist. But now you're getting to a state where if you are that kind of person that can help the country, if you're educated and you can think, why stay in Haiti anymore? I mean, you know, it's time to leave. And so there's a huge brain drain in Haiti. Anyone who graduates from the university tends to come to get out of there. There's no jobs. So it's tough. It's a cycle that feeds on itself.
We have someone else to talk with here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Mm-hmm.
If anything, I admire your perseverance. But not to sound like a Cassandra, I'm not sure. You said earlier on that you wanted to see if you could do something. You'd gone down there and you wanted to see if you could do something for the people of Haiti. Do you think you've accomplished anything? I don't mean to sound like I'm a pessimist, but I'm just.
I think, you know, it's hard being, you know, a white guy and having a family and a job up here to actually have any real effect on what goes on the ground in Haiti. Mm-hmm. What I sort of see my ability or my mission that I can mm-hmm. contribute to is to tell the world and to tell my, you know, my fellow citizens in the United States exactly what's going on right off the shores of Florida. And to not only, you know, you see enough pictures of starving mm-hmm. babies, and if you look at my report, people with bullet holes in them, and people rotting in the morgue, teenage boys rotting in the morgue because they turned off the electricity, so they rot faster, and families can't identify them. You know, that's what I see, what I can do, and I would love it if what I say and the pictures I take and the presentations I make affects one or two people and gets them to make a call to a senator or a congressman or anything, or go to Haiti or contribute some way to a school or an orphanage or something down there.
Yeah, the reason I said that, I don't want to sound like I'm a pessimist, and I really admire what you're doing. It just seems to me like, I think a lot of people in the United States sort of look at they used to call those places third world, sort of like Rwanda. They look and go, well, what's all that about? And there's so many internecine arguments, and like David Inge asked you, well, does anybody have a plan to do anything about this, you know, within the country? And, you know, your response was accurate. No, not really, but somebody's going to have to figure this out. And it almost seems hopeless in the sense that it seems to be, because I was in the Special Forces 35 years ago, and I spent some time in third world countries, and that was back when Pop Doc and Baby Doc were running the show down there. Mm-hmm. And I sort of remember, like, are these places ever going to be straightened out? And it just seems like, you know, an endless sort of endless events against these, you know, like you said, the mass, the average person who's basically in between the power structure and the, you know, outsiders who come in to try to influence them.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I was just gonna add one point. I don't know if it's relevant or not, but John Sayles did a film years ago called Men with Guns, and it's about some sort of, you know, nondescript third world country in Central America. And it basically says a lot of what you say, and just in a, more of an art sense. But I really, really admire what you're doing, and I just want to say that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just one point. I mean, I guess we got to watch it with sort of being maybe racism or elitist, saying they can't fix themselves, you know, which gives us an excuse to stay down there. I think running a country and taking sovereignty over your people and your land is, you know, in a big picture, it looks like it would be complicated, but you know, every country in the world has done it. you know, and it's been done, I don't know, a couple hundred times. I don't know how many countries there are in the world. If Haiti, besides being poor and black, they can take care of themselves, and they can do it, but they've never been allowed. They've physically, politically, economically never been allowed ever to do it. There's been constant intervention by the French, wars, occupation by the United States several times, incredible amount of crushing debt, illegal crushing debt imposed on them by France, which was a big part of this coup because France didn't want to pay the reparations they owed. They've never been allowed to have absolute control of their own country, of their own land, of their own people, except for one moment when there were free and fair elections in 1990 and they elected Aristide. And when it wasn't the U.S.-backed candidate that won, the machinery started. It only took 7 months to destroy a popularly elected government. I mean, they just literally have never been left to take care of themselves. They're constantly being attacked. And they can do it, but we have to be willing to unselfishly run humanitarian programs down there without any agenda of who we want the president to be. And until that happens, it's going to keep happening.
Well, if that coup had not taken place there after Aristide was elected the first time, 1990, and he served less than a year, if that had not taken place and he had had the opportunity to serve out his first term as president, and you're not, in Haiti you can't serve consecutive terms. That's why he had to sit one out before he came back and was elected again. If he had been allowed to serve out that first term, what do you think he would have done? I suppose it's hard to imagine Haiti would be worse off, but do you think that Haiti would be better off?
I think, you know, absolutely. I mean, it was a joyous place when he was elected, and that joy lasted, you know, until he was taken out. And it was just for the first time in 200 years, those people were feeling like we are in control of our own destiny. There's someone in the presidency who became president because he loves us and loves our country, not to get rich. You know, not to kiss up to the United States or anyone else. It was a powerful feeling in Haiti, and it could have gone on. I think the people who had left the country that could contribute to the country started going back. Doctors, lawyers, business people started to see some hope, but it just never got going.
This fall, elections are supposed to be held. Local and municipal elections in October, parliamentary and presidential elections in November, and there is a process of going on now, a registration process trying to get Haitians registered to vote. But given everything that we've talked about so far, what do you think the likelihood of these elections actually taking place would be?
They won't be free, fair, and popular elections. There's no way that it's impossible in the next couple of months to turn that country around and make them free, fair, and popular elections. But I can see them going. I mean, I can see them going on. The UN's whole mandate there is sort of to legitimize this puppet government, which we haven't even talked about. I mean, Haiti has a government, but it was completely chosen by an international group of people and some very elite Haitians. So they're going to have, I think, they're going to have elections, but it's going to be so easily attackable. There's just going to be no legitimacy to it, and I think the international community is going to recognize that you know, when you disenfranchise you know, the majority of the people and don't let the real candidates run because they're in jail, I don't know how you can really look at it as real, but there's been no alternative plan.
Well, the government that's in place now and has been since 2004, when Aristide left or was driven out, depending on how you want to describe what happened, I don't know that government was ever really considered to be anything other than a placeholder. Was it? Did anybody really think that was a serious government?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's all they got. You know, I think it has to be considered serious. I think when La Tortue left his poolside chair in Boca Raton to go back to Haiti, he was making, you know, wonderful speeches. I love my country's in crisis. I'm going to go help. But he hasn't done anything. He's been pretty much a buffoon, and he hasn't really made any speeches in public. He hasn't visited any neighborhoods where the people really live. He's made a bunch of international trips trying to please the different leaders that put him in power. But, you know, it just makes people angrier and angrier that they have this kind of government in place, police doing justice in the street. I just don't know. It was just very poor planning. And I think something else that we touched on a bit is, you know, is there a long-term plan, or is there someone who could think about a long-term plan to fix Haiti? You've got this group, which was backed by the United States, Canada, and France, had a very short-sighted and selfish plan, which was to get Aristide out, but not to say, what are we going to do when he's gone? And now they've got this incredibly huge mess on their hands, tons and tons of blood on their hands. And don't know what to do, because the international community knows it was the choice of the United States, France, and Canada to have that government. And we continue to back it. I mean, there's never any comment by the United States that what's happening down there is wrong.
Mm. What did Aristide say, or what did he propose, that made people in these countries, France, the United States, Canada, think that he was so dangerous? Here, people in the United States, particularly conservatives, mm-hmm. people on the right, saw him as I said in the beginning, they saw him as almost being another Fidel Castro, and said, well, we've got to get rid of this guy because he's mm-hmm. just much too dangerous.
Yep.
What did he say? He didn't really get a chance to do very much. He wasn't president all that long. When he was elected the second time, by that point, there seemed like there was so much unrest. The army was out there as just an almost an independent armed agent supporting his opponents. I wondered, did he ever get a chance to do anything to even demonstrate the fact that he might be dangerous as far as some people are concerned?
Probably maybe one of the most dangerous things he did was to disband the army.
Mm-hmm.
But it was probably like one of the worst armies in the world, and it basically always had its guns aimed not against foreign invaders but against its own people. Committing atrocities, but that was sort of a significant event because the elites lost their private security force when the Haitian army was disbanded. The only other thing, sort of that sort of was well known, is that he raised the minimum wage, and he started to enforce labor laws in the many sweatshops that were down there, and things that and also he, for the first time in the history of Haiti, started to enforce the tax laws down there and wanted business people to actually pay taxes to the government. We're talking a country of 8 million people and a city with, I think, maybe a couple million with one traffic light. You know, we're talking, you know, one traffic light. There's no public works. There's no public sort of fisc. And all he's asking for these people that make millions and millions of dollars to pay their taxes. And that really made them mad because they get to live in Haiti for decades without ever having to do that. So those are two little things. The mm-hmm. big thing that France was upset about was that he was demanding $21 billion in reparations for the $150 million payment that Haiti was forced to pay to France in 1825.
When it became independent.
When it became independent, it became independent in 1804, but France threatened to reinvade and mm-hmm. re-enslave in 1825. If they didn't pay the $150 million in gold. So Haiti decided to pay it. And that goes to what I was talking about before. They've been in debt ever since. I mean, a huge portion of their gross national product has gone to pay off its debt on this loan. And Aristide had actually had filed a suit in international court to get this money, and it was looking very bad for France. And France had actually established a committee to look into the suit and to defend the suit, but it was looking bad, and it wasn't. It was a check of $150 million was illegally forced out of Haiti, and it was pretty sort of a clear cut suit. And I think what they were worried about was how bad France would look, especially a place that considers itself such a liberal country, for doing what it did. They didn't want to lose $21 billion, but I think what the reverberations around the world for colonized and black countries would have been huge. I mean, it would have been a revolutionary event to hear that someone actually paid for slavery, paid the price. So I think that was a scary event for France. Canada owns a lot of land and a lot of business. A lot of Canadian businessmen own huge amounts of land and factories in Haiti. And Aristide, being a popular leader, it just doesn't go with business, or at least they didn't think so.
We're going to have to stop here, I'm afraid, because we're here at the end of the time, and I have a caller that I can't take. For people who are interested in looking at this report that we've mentioned a couple of times, by our guest Thomas Griffin, you can go to the website of the University of Miami Law School and look at this report, Haiti Human Rights Investigation, November 11 through 21, 2004, by our guest Thomas Griffin. He's an attorney in Philadelphia, works in immigration law, among other areas, is particularly interested in human rights with a focus on Haiti, and has been now doing some work in that country for some time, trying at least to get Americans to be aware of the problems of poverty there, has led a number of groups on education and service missions there, and has continued to talk about it. And that's in part how it is we ended up with this report that, again, you can read by going to the Law School, University of Miami website. Mr. Griffin, thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, David.